Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, John Heilman here, and welcome to Hell and High Water, my podcast about politics and culture on the edge of Armageddon. It's a determined, if dubious, committed, if cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, often wrong but rarely in doubt exercise in elevated gas baggery that neither rain nor snow nor heat nor gloom of night nor the toxic rantings of the nuthouse right, a president attempting to invalidate a legitimate election and stage an auto coup complete with an armed insurrection at the United States Capitol, nor, more broadly and arguably even more disturbingly, the capture of a decent-sized chunk of our political, social, and civic spheres by a cadre of incoherent, insidious, conspiracy-addled, autocracy-craving, authoritarian-worshipping lunatics, hustlers, grifters, nihilists, and nincompoops. None of it has kept us from our duly sworn duty and obligations, giving you, our listeners, a fresh episode of this podcast week after week after week after week. Maybe not without fail, because, you know, hashtag epic fail is one of our many mottos around here, but certainly without a pause. We've been doing that for more than 2 years, haven't had a break. All of which is to say that I am plumb shagged out and desperately in need of some R&R. And with the midterm election now comfortably in the rearview mirror and our democracy, amazingly, if I will admit a little unexpectedly, still intact, it seems like a suitable time for the Hell and High Water home office to give itself a fucking break. And so for the next few weeks, that is exactly what we are going to do. And we'll see you back here on the other side of the holidays, tanned, rested, refreshed, revitalized, and raring to go, ready to get back to cranking out more tasty content. In the meantime, don't despair. We're not leaving you entirely in the lurch for these weeks. To the contrary, every Tuesday morning, per usual, you will find a hopefully unfamiliar episode of the podcast doing the backstroke in your feed, dropped there by the able AI factotums who will be minding the store while we're away. And while these episodes that come over the next few weeks may not be fresh or, strictly speaking, new, they will be piping hot, a carefully curated series of Hell and High Water golden oldies, which those of you who've been around from the start may remember, I hope, fondly, and those of you who came along sometime later may never have encountered at all. Given our focus on politics these past few months and our desire not to take a dump on your mood of holiday-inspired good cheer, we've decided these encore presentations will avoid that topic like the plague and focus instead on culture, entertainment, technology, and such with a run of some of our most favorite guests in those realms over the past 2 years, including this beauty right here, which, whether or not you've heard it before, you will not want to miss. And so with that, we leave you to it with a hearty and heartfelt namaste. Hey everyone, John Heilman here, and welcome to Hell and High Water, my podcast for the recount about politics and culture on the edge of Armageddon, with big ups to my pal RZA, the presiding genius behind the sound of Wu-Tang Clan, and the producer of our dope theme music. After more than 2 weeks of non-stop wall-to-wall coverage of the war in Ukraine, coverage that gets bloodier, more brutal, harder to watch and to stomach with each passing day, you might very well be looking for the occasional distraction on the tube, a sporadic respite from the relentless bombardment of your senses and your soul on cable news. Something fun, something funny, something uplifting and lighthearted, the kind of thing my dearly departed father used to talk about fondly, wistfully, and precisely in moments like this. flying down to Rio, my dad would say, whenever the shit got really heavy. Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers dancing on the wings of airplanes. Well, then, dear listeners, you're in luck. Times two. Because this episode of the podcast is, in fact, a purely distilled form of escapism. An audio no-fly zone in which there will be 0.0% discussion of Ukraine, Russia, Zelensky, Putin, Biden, barrel bombs, tactical nukes, chemical weapons, none of it. And we'll instead highlight a new TV series that you really gotta watch. And while it's not exactly flying down to Rio, in that it's a dark and disorienting sci-fi thriller about alienation, grief, shadowy and conspiratorial corporate skullduggery, surgical and possibly irrevocable consciousness alteration in service of the ever-elusive work-life balance, and a generally dystopian future that bears certain uncanny similarities to our present-day reality, it is incredibly good, fully absorbing, and wildly distracting in the best possible way. The series is called Severance. It premiered a few weeks ago on Apple TV+, drops new episodes every Friday, and is about halfway through its first season, so it's the perfect time to dive in right now, which you will certainly want to do after listening to our conversation here today with Severance's star, the one and only Adam Scott.
When you're in the throes of trying to, you know, cobble an acting career together and convincing yourself that you're doing just fine, which is what I had to do for those 15 years, is constantly think like, this is exactly the way it's supposed to be. Doing great. But it's not until you actually hit on something and get some traction that you look back and realize like, oh my God, I was nowhere.
If you are an Adam Scott fan, and I mean what thinking person with any taste whatsoever isn't an Adam Scott fan, you surely think of him primarily as a comedic actor, and with good reason. After graduating from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in Los Angeles, Scott made his debut on TV in 1994 and then spent the next decade plus living from paycheck to paycheck, schlepping from minor part to minor part, hanging on in the business, as he puts it, quote, by a piece of floss, unquote. Then, in 2008, came Scott's big break, the role of Derek Hough, the uber douchebag bro character in Adam McKay's classic Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly comedy, Step Brothers, after which Scott's career exploded, making him a ubiquitous and much loved, or when called for, much hated, or really much loved for being much hated, presence in TV shows such as Party Down, Eastbound and Down, Parks and Recreation, and The Good Place, and films such as Friends with Kids, Bachelorette, Sleeping with Other People, and The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. It was working on that last film, Walter Mitty, where Scott met Ben Stiller, the executive producer, director, and presiding creative force behind Severance. Like Scott, Stiller has long been known mainly for his estimable body of comedic work, but with his widely and rightly lauded 2018 series Escape at Dannemora, and now with Severance, Stiller is now staking a claim as a dramatic director of the first rank, and something similar may be in store for Scott as an actor. He's earned plenty of accolades for his performance as Ed McKenzie in two seasons of HBO's Big Little Lies, but his work in Severance is on another level entirely. Textured, subtle, at times tortured, and so persistently riveting that even amid a standout cast that includes Patricia Arquette and John Turturro and Christopher Walken, he basically carries the entire series on his back. Adam stopped by the Recount's offices last month when he was in New York to hit Colbert and Good Morning America to launch Severance. We talked about the trials of making the series during the pandemic, from coping with the loss of his mother not long before COVID hit, to living alone and apart from his family for months during production, to getting the bug himself during filming, and the ways the material rhymed with the forbidding and unnerving moment the country has been going through these past few years. We also took a walk down memory lane discussing some of his comedic high points, including Party Down, which, as it happens, Adam is currently shooting six all-new episodes of for Starz to air later this year, as well as our mutual and equally fervid love for Talking Heads, U2, and REM, three iconic bands to which Adam and his friend Scott Aukerman have devoted a long-running and wildly enjoyable podcast. But worry not,
Those of you looking forward to the promised diversion from the horrors of what Russia is doing to Ukraine, there is no talk about life during wartime here, or Sunday Bloody Sunday, or it's the end of the world as we know it, even though, you know, it may be. Instead, there's just a delightful chat with a very fine actor who, in different ways, with both Severance and the forthcoming Party Down reboot, is doing his best to keep our minds off of the flickering flames and the rising tides of our current state of hell and high water.
Hello, my name is Mark S., and I have, of my own free accord, elected to undergo the procedure known as severance. I give consent to sever my memories between my work life and my personal life. I acknowledge that once the procedure is complete, I will be unable to access my personal memories whilst on the severed floor.
Say gratitude.
Nor will I retain work memories.
Hey!
Sorry. When I return home at the end of the day. I make these statements freely.
Normally, I don't like to play trailers. Like, trailers are not great. That trailer, though, actually lays out a lot of what the series is about, right? So, does he make those statements freely?
That's a really good question. Yes, because I think a lot of, you know, when people go in and get severed, get the procedure done, it's something they choose to do, that they've decided they want to do with their life. And yeah, they make that statement freely. The half of them that is severed, that is at work, that is unaware of the outside world or who they are in the outside world, they didn't make that choice. The person on the outside world made that choice for them.
There's a dinner scene where one of the guys that your character is talking to says, you know, so you're basically a prisoner there at the office. I guess without spoilers, talk about what the setup is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a dystopian workplace drama that's in the realm of sci-fi. These are not normal genres for you, by the way.
Right.
But that has the setup that we just described. This is what these people undergo. But what's it really about? And what was it that made this appealing to you, given that it's not really your genre, right? You've done a lot of drama, you've done a lot of comedy, but not a lot of sci-fi.
You know, you get this chip implanted in your brain, so when you go to work and get on the elevator, there's something triggered in the chip. So while you're at work, you have no idea who you are in the outside world, vice versa. When you take the elevator up at the end of the day, it gets triggered back. And in the outside world, you lose all the memories of what you did that day at work. So it's two separate lives. I mean, when I read it, first Ben Stiller told me about the idea in like January of 2017. I remember I was standing in the snow. It's Sundance, and he called me and just kind of gave me the elevator pitch, like the three sentence big idea, the hook of the show. And I couldn't kind of get it out of my head and didn't read an actual script for another couple of years. When I read the script, my initial reaction was like, this is exactly what I want to watch. This is the kind of show that I love watching, purely from an audience member's perspective. As far as being a part of it, I've never had a chance to really be a part of something like that. So I thought if I get to actually land this job, it almost felt like this is what I've been working towards. What I've been kind of earning for 20 odd years is a chance to get a role like this in a show like this with someone like Ben and Dan Erickson, who created and wrote it. So to me, it really felt like the culmination of everything that sort of came before.
It's interesting because it is dystopian. I mean, just the way it looks is kind of like early 70s noir.
Parallax sci-fi. View.
Parallax almost. View, like a noir sci-fi, which is kind of like, or like a little bit of Blade Runner to it. Like there's like, not quite so techie, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, it's very dark.
Yep.
And it's meant to make you feel alienated as you watch it. And you get that, right? I mean, first of all, this is 17, right? When Ben's talking to you about it, right?
Yeah.
Trump has just been elected.
Yeah.
That sense of dystopian things
were starting to seem more like this kind of wave of dystopian stuff was about to happen, right? Also, this kind of like evil corporations doing stuff, again, very early 70s, mm-hmm. kind of popping up in the culture. By the time you guys get to shoot it, we're in the middle of the pandemic. Yeah. We're like, it couldn't be more dystopian, right? So again, I ask you, like, what do you think it's about? What's the show really like about at core? Alienation at work about, I mean, people can make glib comments about the work-life balance or whatever, but what's it really getting into yeah. that connects with the culture? Because I think it does.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't really answer your,
that's
your
okay.
question. I mean, I think that's all a great way in to the characters. I mean, for me, I feel the show, at least this season, is largely about grief and how to come to terms with grief. I think it's about many things, but that's kind of where I found it, was this character who is grieving his wife and chooses the severance procedure to exit his life for 10 hours a day, whatever, just so he doesn't have to feel. And this other side of him still has those feelings inside of him, but just doesn't know what they are, how to locate or name it. But physiologically, those things are still there. And so it's about this person and both halves of this person coming to terms with a lot of things. But for me, I felt it was mainly grief.
Right.
And all the corporate stuff and all of that is incredibly important too. But I guess when you're asking like the core of what it's about,
right.
for me, that's where it lies.
I remember we were texting about this when you came out here, right? You came to New York to shoot this thing in October 2020. And you were here for 9 months, 8 months?
Yeah.
Long time, right? Peak COVID time, yeah. right? You're living like basically alone in like an apartment in Tribeca, yeah. far away from your family.
Yeah.
And your mom had just died?
Yeah.
I'm asking about this because of yeah. grief. It seems like shooting stuff during COVID was hard for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, the circus was in production. We had the challenges of yeah. that. But it seems like your experience with this would have been even more like emotionally resonant.
Yeah.
If that's what the show's about grief, you're having your own experience of grief and you're having to go through it in this very dislocated, weird environment where you're yeah. like basically isolated for a long shoot with a lot yeah. of complexity and a lot of people getting sick and some people dying and all that
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah. Pandemic New York pre-vaccine was a whole different world.
Yeah.
I mean, it was nuts. And, you know, I have wife, a son, and a daughter in Los Angeles. My mom died like days before pandemic, days before lockdown. And so we actually didn't end up having a memorial for her until this past December
right.
because of, you know, everything, obviously. So yeah, I, you know, over the 5-6 months of lockdown, I was in with the three people who I love the most, who love me the most, and I don't want to say cushioned the blow, but they loved me. And so we kind of, you know, the loss of my mom was, they really helped me through it, as, you know, family does. And then suddenly, like you said, I found myself here alone in October of 2020, and that changes things. And so you're alone in an apartment in a city that's locked down. I, you know, I have friends here, but it's not like there was a ton of socializing, and I couldn't get sick because the show would have to shut down. I did get COVID at one point and did have to shut down. So yeah, I realized then, sitting in this apartment by myself, that I had a lot of grieving still to do, and I had to come to terms with this loss. And the only place I had to turn to really was the show. And so I came to terms with her death and with my grieving through the show more than anything.
Do you think that I'm always curious about this, right? An actor in a role like this, right, you bring a lot of your stuff to, mm-hmm. to the table, right? So
yeah.
given your circumstances, it seems natural that the grief element would be a thing that you would attach yourself to in this material, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that's because it's innately in the material, or do you think that's more like what you're bringing to the material? Like, if I had asked Ben about it in 2017 when the script was first yeah. coming together, well, he would have said, yeah, this is a meditation on grief.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. That's why I say for
right?
me,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
what it was about, yeah. because it was. Thank God the show was there for me at that time. If the show was about dancing, I don't know if I would have been able to really go through this grieving process that I kind of allowed myself too. The show and the character circumstances allowed for me to really dig into it and figure it out. And, you know, I can't speak for Ben, but Ben lost his father around the same time.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I think we were both feeling it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Let me play this other clip from the first episode between Mark Adams' character and a woman who appears in this first episode.
Britt Lauer. Yeah.
So I'll never leave here.
You'll leave at 5. Well, actually, they stagger our exit. So 5:15. But it won't feel like it, not to this version of you, anyway.
Do you have a family?
You'll never know.
And I have no choice.
Well, every time you find yourself here, it's because you chose to come back.
I mean, that kind of goes back to the first question I asked you, which is like, how much do you freely consent, right? I mean, it seems like that's another thing that's in this show. But it seems like one of the other things that's kind of being grappled with here is this notion of free will.
Yeah.
On some level, you've played a lot of characters, like 123 film and TV credits. That's a lot of credits, right? When you first got this, we're headed in to do this. I remember you saying to me, this is like terrain I haven't really explored before.
Yeah.
But you were more talking about genre terrain. It was like, I've never really done sci-fi before. This is really mind-bendy. Like, I'm really psyched to be doing this. Mm-hmm. But it's also, it seems like, alongside a lot of the more dramatic parts you've done, this is also, in some way, even past some of those in terms of the kind of philosophical core that's in the middle of it. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, it is really interesting because the version of my character, Mark, who's on the inside of Lumen, you know, when we find him at the beginning of the story, he's kind of somewhat of a company man. He's not asking any questions. He's just keeping his head down and doing his work. And then Helly, played by Britt Lauer, comes along and starts asking questions that no one wants her to ask.
Right.
But you can't put that toothpaste back in the tube. And so once you start thinking about free will and the fact that you're down here working this job and you didn't choose to do that, but you kind of did, just a different version of you did, then pretty quickly you start feeling a little unsettled and unmoored because this is your entire existence.
Right.
So yeah, the philosophical and sort of ethical questions just sort of sprout out from there.
You're basically playing two versions of this guy, right? There's the company man,
mm-hmm.
the version of himself that is at the office and the version of himself outside. You see that even in the first couple episodes, like they're different.
Yeah.
You know, and the outside guy, the outside version of Mark is angrier, funnier, drunker. Like there's much more emotional turmoil going on with him.
Yeah.
And I wonder how that evolves over the course of the series and what a kind of challenge that is to play essentially in the course of one limited series or one series that might go on, I don't know, but playing basically two different versions of the same human that are both true to him in some way. They're both just him.
Yeah.
It's all his consciousness, right? But they're different guys. And it's not Jekyll and Hyde, but there's a challenge to that, right?
Yeah, it was something we had to figure out early on, which was, and came to the conclusion that it was important to me and to Ben and to Dan Erickson, who created the show, that this be one dude. It's not two different characters. It's one guy. It's just different parts or different halves of one guy. But it needed to feel like the same person, just different parts. We all have different parts. You know, depending on who you're talking to, you behave slightly differently. So it was kind of an amalgam of that and trying to figure out which behaviors would apply to one or the other. Or, you know, one of them has 40 odd years of joy and sorrow and all of those things that go into a big full life. And the other one is, for all intents and purposes, like 2.5 years old and is only carrying with him what he knows and what they allowed him to know.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, the instinct for an actor is like, oh, okay, I have two different characters. I want this one to have a mustache and this one to have a fedora with a feather in it. Or at least that's what I wanted to do. Ben would not let me.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it was tricky. And, you know, we shot it all at once, all 9 episodes at once, jumping around.
Sure.
And so we would do both halves in one day, sometimes back and forth a few times. So we had to not only remember which of the two halves we were doing for behavior's sake and for posture or voice or whatever we're doing, but also where in the story they were, because both sides of him have their own kind of independent arcs they go on.
When we started this show, we were just in the very early phase of the pandemic. We were like thinking about wanting to do a show that was not like a pandemic show, but was more about the way that the pandemic connected to a much larger sense of kind of end times, where people, like, between the economy cratering and the pandemic happening and Trump being in office and like all of this stuff, the racial justice things ended up feeding into that in 2020. Yeah. But there was this moment of like the wheels are coming off the wagon for a lot of people that was not just about the pandemic. That was like this kind of apocalyptic sense of dread that a lot of people had. And I thought that that period, we didn't know how long it was going to be at that point, but it turned out to be 2 years, would produce a bunch of interesting shit in like what people decided to make, how they decided to cope with that. How do they channel it? How do they turn it into art? What would it do to our politics? What would it do to the work, the way that, you know, remote, we're sitting in this giant office here at the Recount. We've been trying to get this office open since October. And we're just now finally to the point.
Is that right?
I mean, like, we moved into this office in October and we're like, everybody's coming back in October. Nope, not doing that. Sucks. It's like, we've got space here for all these people. Yeah. And we're now literally just last week, we're saying, okay, 3 days a week, come in, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, people's relationship to their offices, their colleagues, their coworkers, a lot of people who've worked at this place for like a year and never met each other, right?
Yeah, that's so weird.
So it's this moment, right? And I guess my question is whether, A, you feel like part of the power of this thing, because Severance to me feels very much a product of that moment. Yeah. Just starting to see the stuff that got made in that 2 years, right? Yeah. And this is one of the early things. It feels very much to me in sync with that sense of dread and that sense of unease and dislocation and alienation and fear and all that. And I wonder whether you feel like that's true too, like this is a product of the moment, and whether for you, you had that same sense of like apocalyptic dread in that period and whether you're past it now.
Just to be clear, I've never been past apocalyptic dread for as long as
I've been apocalyptic since the early, since your child in Santa Cruz, you've been on the apocalyptic
100%. I mean, it was written before pandemic. We were starting in April 2020. That's when we were going to start, delayed 6 months. Yeah. But it certainly contributed to just sort of the overall tenor of the thing, certainly when we were making it. I worked with this large group of people for 9 months, and the entire crew, I never saw the bottom half of their faces. Usually you're, after that amount of time, you're kind of bonded with everybody, and I didn't see a lot of them, nor did any of the other actors. And the actors, we would do a scene and then you immediately put your masks, especially pre-vaccine, put your masks on and go off into your separate rooms. There's no going out to dinner with your castmates, and you know, there's none of that. It was just weird. Like I said, I was alone in an apartment or working on Severance with fluorescent lights and bright green carpet and at a desk. Like, it was a weird existence. Yeah. I mean, at one point my family's gonna come out like for Thanksgiving or something, but then there was a COVID scare on set, so they had to cancel. I didn't see them for 3 months at a time. It was just bonkers. So all of that alienation for me, but for every single person on the production, I think certainly permeated the show, even though the material itself
pre-existed. I mean, look, I mean, some of that stuff, that apocalyptic stuff, predates the pandemic. Like I say, Trump, I mean, for people feeling like the wheels are coming off the wagon in American democracy, well, that preceded the pandemic was an accelerant to that. And on top of that, there's just the question of like how culture works, which is like, who knows why it happens, but someone makes a thing. You know, The Leftovers is a series I just went back and watched. It's a series that was made before the pandemic law, but when you watch it now, and an incredible series when it aired, but watch it now. And I just rewatched it, and I'm like, it's more harrowing and more powerful and emotional because of what happened. So like, you know, time marches on, things happen, and then the way that the art gets absorbed in the culture. And I think for Severance, part of the way it's going to hit people is, regardless of when it was written or what was on the writers' minds when it was all put together, was like how it lands now.
Absolutely.
In this moment, right?
Absolutely. You know, actually, when I first talked to Ben in 2017 about the show, I was standing outside in the snow, but he had just announced a travel ban January 2017. It was right after inauguration. What did he announce it? Later that day or the next day?
I was actually at Sundance. We didn't see each other there, but we had the Trump movie that was out, that we had just done the Trump movie on the basis of the first year of the circus. So I was there that same at Sundance, that same period. And there was like the Women's March happened the first week of Sundance.
That's right.
We were watching it on the news.
That's right.
From Sundance going, wow.
Well, somehow I was in the Women's March, but also at Sundance. So I must have just gone from one to the other.
Yeah.
But there was those protests for travel ban. Remember? It was
Oh
my God, protests. because Women's March had just happened. We had to get to the airport and protest this bullshit. Right. So protesting became like, you know, a cultural thing. Like, am I going to see you at LAX or at, you know, Burbank or wherever the next protest was? Yeah. Suddenly it was thrust upon us, this new thing. And yeah, it all felt apocalyptic because we didn't know what was coming. Him getting inaugurated and hitting us with the travel ban right away, it was scary because what's next? And I think that's was all 4 years of that presidency was, like you said, this dread of what is on the other side of this cliff we're surely about to fall off of.
In some ways, it's like the pandemic, in a narrative sense, not in a real sense, the pandemic was kind of inevitable. If you're writing this story, if you're writing the novel of it, you're like, oh, of course, in the year of Trump, you will have now some giant plague, huge thing that will show just how incompetent they are and also kill a lot of people push us. And then, you know, then the Black Lives Matter protests and everything else. All that stuff feels like kind of the natural culmination of a bunch of shit that was rolling along for 3 years leading into it.
Right? Because all those years, those 3 years leading up to it, people like you that I listen to and watch all the time all along were saying, well, just thank God there's no catastrophe that he has to handle.
Yes.
I mean, thank God we've been relatively safe these first few years of this presidency. And then the worst thing could happen. And of course, they completely fuck it up.
I'm going to ask you one question about Ben, but I want to play this Secret Life of Walter Mitty. You guys were in a movie together in 2013. Let's play that. We'll talk about you and Ben on the other side. Ben Stiller, that is.
And what do you do, Cake Man?
I do the cakes just for today. I'm not a cake man. I do I deal directly with life's photo units to manage.
Sorry,
negative.
I was really getting into this song. I stopped listening to you.
I was saying, you know who looks good in a beard? Dumbledore, not you.
Guy? What do you do?
I'm a negative asset manager.
Worth the wait.
So, like, the beard's incredible. That's, like, one of my favorite beards of your beard. Yeah. So it's, like, a nice fake beard underneath there. Also, you're, like, in kind of classic Adam Scott dick mode in that.
Sure.
Is that the first time you guys have worked together?
That was, yeah. We met at, like, a premiere or something on a red carpet. He just came up and introduced himself because he had, like, Step Brothers. And I was so thrown. I couldn't believe I was meeting Ben Stiller.
Yeah.
And other than that, we had never really interacted. And then he asked me to do Walter Mitty. And it was, of course, so much fun.
And thus a beautiful friendship was born that leads us to Severance. Like, Ben's, like, become, like, a hardcore. I mean, not that he hasn't done great stuff in the past, but, you know, Dannemora
was
a great piece of work. He's now, like, an A-list director.
Yeah, he's one of our great filmmakers.
Right.
I mean, I've thought this for a long time, but I'm so happy that
the world thinks it.
Yeah, you know? Because I thought Walter Mitty was extraordinary and unfairly treated. Dannemora is a masterpiece, but also there's Cable Guy, Reality Bites, Zoolander. I mean, Tropic Thunder is a masterpiece as well. But Dannemora is really, and I think also since he was behind the camera, people could really focus in and see his filmmaking for what it is. And it's just unbelievable. I've watched the Dannemora series several times and just can't get over how good it is. I really do put it up there with, like, The Wire, The Sopranos, and, you know, Hamilton is, like, these great American works of the past, you know, 25 years or so.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think it's like, I'm the last person to be an anti-comedy snob, but I do think, like, A, him doing these things that are just purely dramatic and going behind the camera, not being on camera causes people to focus, like, okay, this is just auteur work now.
Yeah.
He's not kind of like straddling lanes here.
That's right.
I think the focus has helped him. I mean, has helped his reputation, helped people be clear about how great he really is and how smart he is. And
that's right.
And I think Dannemora is great. And I think, you know, the Severance thing is going to push him up in that kind of pantheon more.
Yeah. And I think if people go back and watch Walter Mitty with that same eye, looking at the filmmaking like that, you see just what an extraordinary piece of filmmaking it is. And Tropic Thunder, too.
Well, for sure. I feel like it's fair to suck up to Ben since he's not here.
Sure.
If he were here,
there's no way we
wouldn't say anything like really nice about it. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Adam Scott on Hell and High Water.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Hell and High Water.
All right, I want to step back now. Go back into like a little bit of the Scott history here.
The skistry?
The skistry. Now, like we found the first television appearance in Dead at 21 in 1994.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
Where did you find it?
Oh, you want to see that? Well, here we go. Let's play that. Let's play
number
five.
Oh, my
God. Here it is.
Where
Dead at 21 in 1994.
Oh, my God.
Oh, we have great researchers. Here it comes. Playing Dan Beard.
Dan Beard.
Hi. My name is Dan Beard. My name is Dan Beard. I hope I'm talking to Ed, but if I am, that probably means I'm dead. Which I gotta say is pretty weird. Look, I'll make this quick, because you got no time, and I got even less. Think you're a regular kid? Well, sorry, bud. You're a lab rat, part of a government experiment. Lab rat. You're part of a government plan to make smarter humans through neurocybernetics.
First of all, that looks nothing like you. Second of all,
that's weird.
Strange connections to like the current work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little like the neurocybernetic, cybernaut, you're part of an experiment.
That's 1993, I think.
Okay, well, we thought it was 1994, but
that's when it came out. Yeah.
That's when it came out, when you did the work. Now, I want to play one more thing. Let's play Boy Meets World here, a little clip from that, because this is more like what we think of when we think about Adam Scott. Then we can talk about the very early days, the salad days of this.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Griffin Hawkins. Call me Griff. Thanks for filling in for me. I didn't think I'd make it. I'm not usually a morning person, but I wanted to make a good impression.
You're Griffin Hawkins.
He sure is.
Thank you, Miss Gill. You may go.
Do I have to?
Yes.
Erica, we'll finish up later.
Take a seat, Mr. Hawkins.
I mean,
look, when you got it, you got it. Griff had it.
He had it, right?
Oh, my God.
People love Boy Meets World, right?
People love Boy Meets World.
Name Party Down is more of a cult classic. We'll get to that in a little bit. But Boy Meets World is a little bit of a cult classic.
They'll
launch some careers.
Sure.
You know?
A lot of people did guest spots on Boy Meets World. But Boy Meets World is like seminal kind of childhood television for, you know, people in their 30s.
Yes.
Now.
And Griffin is like a little bit of a sexier Ferris Bueller jam going on there, right?
Yeah, and I think
everybody's kind of in awe of him. Everyone's
he's like the cool guy at school, like snap the fingers and like his lackeys go out and
Ferris Bueller meets Arthur Fonzarelli.
Sure, yeah, sure, I'll take
it. You'll take that. Right?
I mean, I was only in like three episodes, but it's sort of infamous in a way, I guess. I don't know.
So if we talk about the Scott career, right? If I read this right, if I put this as bluntly as you put it, basically, it's kind of like 15 years of kind of just scrapping along, trying to get by.
Yep.
You're not really breaking through, not really getting traction, but you're getting parts, you're getting small things, you're taking whatever comes your way. Is that fair?
Doing whatever I can.
I know you told the story in the New York Times about your wife kind of saying, do you have a plan B?
Yeah.
Was that like really a moment where you were like, fuck, man, like maybe this isn't going to work?
I think that when you're in the throes of trying to, you know, cobble an acting career together and convincing yourself that you're doing just fine, which is what I had to do for those 15 years, is constantly think like, this is exactly the way it's supposed to be.
Right,
I'm doing great. But it's not until you actually hit on something and get some traction that you look back and realize like, oh my God, I was nowhere and it was just, you know, having to drum up my own delusion just to keep myself going for years. But when you're in the middle of that kind of self-delusion and someone comes and asks you what your backup plan is.
And someone who loves you.
Yeah.
Not just someone, not just a
random. Someone like sits you down and says, listen, just curious.
Honey, sweetheart, darling, I love you to death, but.
I've been paying the rent now for a couple of years. Right. So I think when she asked me that, it was a heartbreaking moment. I remember I was up for the pilot of Six Feet Under, right?
Yeah.
As far as I remember, it was me or Michael C. Hall. It went to by far the right person because Michael C. Hall was brilliant on it and is great. And I wouldn't have been nearly as good. I was not ready, nor do I have the skills that Michael Hall has. But when I lost out on that, it was like a torpedo that sunk me for a while. Right. You know, it was tough. And it may have been in that era that she asked me what my backup plan was.
And the thing is, if you look at the credits, you look at the stuff you did from 1994 to Step Brothers, like basically 14 years.
Sure.
There's one that really stands out in the middle of it that would have been the kind of thing in Aviator.
All of a sudden,
like you're in the Aviator, a Scorsese movie with Leonardo DiCaprio and Jude Law and Cate Blanchett. And you're like, this is not a big part, but like you're in a Scorsese movie. Yeah. That would be the kind of thing that would feed the notion of like, okay, actually I'm making progress.
Yes.
Right? Things in 2004. So it's basically 10 years in.
Yes.
You're like, oh, there's a milestone. Yes. Like I'm about to maybe start to break
That's
through.
Right. And I remember I wrapped my work on The Aviator on exact 10-year anniversary of when I arrived in Hollywood.
Right.
Halloween of 2003, I wrapped Aviator. And I remember I went out, met up with John Hamm to grab beers on that night. And both of us were plugging away, not sure if anything was going to kind of come together for us. I had this small role in the Scorsese movie, which of course was great. But we were both, I think, in this tough spot of, is this ever going to happen?
Yeah.
And luckily, you know, we both kept plugging away. But that was something where I was like, okay, well, I'm doing something right. Because, you know, I had, you know, the audition process to be in a Scorsese movie is rigorous as it should be. But, you know, I got to go spend the summer working with him.
Until this point, there's not really Adam Scott doing comedy.
Yeah, that's
comic
right.
actor. This is not one of those things. All of a sudden, you're in Step Brothers.
Yeah.
2008. A movie that almost kind of defines now a certain thing that now happens to movies, which is like a movie that people didn't really like when it came out.
Yeah.
Critics were not kind to it.
Not at all.
Didn't do a lot of business. It was fine, but like not, you know, not enormous. And now people love it.
Yeah.
You know, like in the way that things happen now in our world. Yeah. First of all, long runs on cable. Then now it's on streaming and you can go find it. And people love Step Brothers.
Like,
so how does a guy who has no comedy credits whatsoever find himself in what, because now seen as one of the classic comedies of a certain, you know, Adam McKay, Will Ferrell, the genius of the age. How do you get that job?
It was a total fluke. Someone had the role and had to drop out. So they had to cast it quickly. So they had these last minute auditions. And I went and just figured there's no way I'm getting this. So I'm terrible at auditioning, but the ones that have gone well are usually when I don't give a shit or think there's no way this is going to happen. Right. So why not take a big swing? And I did. And it just sort of clicked and I got the job. And I was as astounded as anyone that I got this nice big role. I mean, the script was so funny as the movie is. You read it and you're like, I can't believe they're making this. Yeah. This is insane. It was great. And I knew Judd a little bit because I had a small role in Knocked Up and Friends with Rudd. And so that totally helped. Shauna Robertson put me in Knocked Up. I got to know Judd a little bit. Allison Jones was a casting director who I'd known for years. She got me in front of McKay. So it was kind of knowing, you know, people over the years that helped get me in there. And then McKay hired me, luckily.
So you had like these various connections to the comedy world, even though you weren't really in the comedy world.
Yeah.
All right. I want to play Benito Fish just to hear Little Step Brothers because, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Adam Scott kind of defining just what a dick he can be for laughs.
Yeah.
know. We were so sad you guys couldn't come to the wedding.
We completely understand.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you were busy fishing with Mark Cuban.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, not just the Cubes, but we had Chris Daughtry, Jeff Probst, Super Chef Bobby Flay. I mean, it was insane. I mean, it was almost too much.
My God, that's impressive.
Yeah, we were down in the southern part of the Gulf fishing Bonita. Robert, have you ever been down to the southern part of the Gulf on the Bonita Run?
Always wanted to. Yeah, I hear it's amazing.
It is. It's gorgeous.
Are Bonita fish big?
What?
Dale, don't interrupt the man when he's telling a story.
No, it's fine, Robert.
I was asking about the story.
What's this guy's deal?
I don't know, son. It's okay. Well, Dale, they are what's called a trophy fish. So, yeah, they're pretty big.
I mean, what a prick.
Seriously, right? This kind of becomes archetypal Amscott thing, right, going forward, right? And it works for you.
Yeah.
Which means there must be some of that inside you somewhere, right? Like somewhere deep down, you're kind of like seem like a nice guy, but there's got to be some kind of like bro douchebag lurking deep in there.
It's got to be in there somewhere.
Because it comes out so naturally.
I think it's so fun. I think assholes are so funny.
Yes.
Especially assholes who are just super confident. I mean, there's nothing funnier than an overconfident moron, as Will Ferrell and Steve Martin and Martin Short and everyone funny has ever proven. You know, I always loved William Atherton's performance in Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Just a delicious villain. Delicious is a gross adjective to use, but I'm going to stick to it. I kind of saw this role as something along those lines, as the prick in the big comedy. And yeah, I find douchebags really entertaining. But you're right, it must be in there somewhere, because it's kind of easy for me to access.
Well, I mean, you don't get typecast exactly, but there's some elements of this character that come up in a lot of future stuff that which you were, there's like, hey, that's an Adam Scott type. Let's get back on
it.
He can play this dick the way that I want him to be played.
There are many more that I didn't end up, after Step Brothers, I got a lot of asshole attention and tried to pick and choose wisely.
Here's a guy who's not afraid to be an asshole on camera.
Yeah, exactly.
Does not care about his Q rating. It's all good.
That's right.
But I mean, just working with those guys, though, man, just like all the performances in that movie are so fucking great. I mean, they're just on fire. Every single one of them, the more traditional non-comic actor, Steenburgen, like all these people are playing doing great. And then John C. Reilly and Ferrell are just off.
They were great. And I didn't know what I was doing. I hadn't really improvised much before working on this movie, and that's what those guys do. And so I just sort of learned on the job, and it was like learning, you know, to throw the javelin at the Olympics with the stadium full of people and the cameras and lights on you. And it took me a while, and I was not great, and they, you know, cut me together well, but it wasn't until like towards the end of the movie that I really kind of felt like I found my footing. But after we finished, I kind of felt like, why would I want to do anything else? This is so fun. Catherine Hahn, by the way, we played husband and wife, and we were both there like, I can't believe I got this job, both of us. I was struggling, but she was like right out of the gate. She knew exactly what she was doing.
Right.
And excellent, as you can see.
There comes out of this just a string of kind of like great parts. And like Eastbound and Down is a great example.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you're only two episodes of the show, right?
Yeah.
And everybody remembers that character.
Yeah.
Now great it is. Let's play Pat Anderson getting out of rehab after his season one.
Man,
in the first episode, first season that you're in, you're coked out of your mind.
Yeah.
In the second season, you are now in rehab and getting out of rehab and having a little conversation with your sponsor.
Oh, yeah. Jody Hill, actually,
yes,
playing the sponsor. Yeah.
I want to ask your old sponsor one more question.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it's convenient because you're at the top of my list.
I'm at the top of your list.
I fucked Linda.
Oh, okay. You fucked my sister.
Isn't your wife's name Linda?
You fucked my wife?
I did, but I thought her name was Linda. Isn't that Linda?
It's Beth.
Beth. Right. Right, of course. No, yeah, Linda was your sister. She watched.
She watched?
Yeah, it's crazy. But I'm sorry about that, and I hope we can make amends. This is Clean and Soaps, full force, because I feel like I'm on a new drug.
Just get the fuck out of here, Pat.
Well, as long as we're square.
I forgot about that completely.
First of all, the fact that he's fucked the guy's wife
and
forgotten her name. Which is like, there's just this
terrible.
It's just an incredible,
terrible.
It's an incredible thing.
Yeah, that's Jody Hill, who directed a lot of Eastbound. He's really funny, yeah.
like a joy to be on that show.
Oh,
a great
yeah,
show.
It was so
again,
fun.
An incredible show. Could that show be made today?
I don't know. You know,
the earlier scene you're talking about, which is about the Jonas Brothers, yeah. And there's like, I mean, it's a filthy show.
Filthy
yeah. show. Yeah, and so much of the humor is like transgressive, over the line, totally yeah. not PC. I don't know. Could that show get made today?
I don't know. Probably not. I mean, yeah. Kenny Powers is a misogynist. But, you know, those guys are so smart. They're writing that character in such a smart, enlightened way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it would get made now or if it's too crazy, but what a fun show. Eastbound is great. And, you know, Vice Principals and Righteous Gemstones are also incredible shows. Those guys are great.
We're going to take one more break, and we'll be back with more Adam Scott on Hell and High Water.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And we are back with Adam Scott on Hell and High Water.
If I had you for like 3 hours, I would spend a long time talking about Sleeping with Other People, which is really like one of my favorite movies.
Cool.
I love Leslie Headland. I think she's incredibly smart and she like everything she makes is great. And she's love that role, even though it's like in your oeuvre, it's a relatively minor thing. I love that movie though. And basically everything about Sudeikis that now is true in Ted Lasso is basically in that movie.
Yeah.
But we won't talk about it. I do want to talk about Parks and Rec though, because it's like Parks and Rec is the good place we have to talk about. And then we're going to talk about Party Down and a little bit about music.
But yes, Leslie Headland, man. This is incredible.
She's incredible, right? She's just like an underrated star.
You know. Well, she's doing a Star Wars show now.
She is. Yeah. She is. That's a fact. I'm not sure. Not Don Baby knows about that, but that's true. Let's play calzones.
So, Ben, why calzone?
Glad you asked, Chris. You know, there's fast food hamburgers, there's fast food Mexican, there's fast food Chinese, blah, blah, blah. Have you ever wondered why there isn't a fast food option for Italian food?
What about pizza?
Pizza? Never heard of it. That's what people will be saying in 20 years, because pizza is old news, Chris. Pizza is your grandfather's calzone.
Never thought of it that way.
What I'm talking about is a portable, delicious meal that is its own container. It's a whole new spin on Italian fast casual dining.
Amazing.
Now, you of all people like this. I'm going to use low-fat ingredients.
Game changer.
And I will call my new Italian fast casual eatery the Low-Cal Calzone Zone.
This is like one of the great comedy series of our lifetime, right?
Parks?
Yeah.
I thought that before I joined the show
because
I didn't get there till the end of season two and they were already one of the great comedies. And Mike and Amy really built something truly special. If I wasn't on it, I would feel exactly the same way.
What do you think it is about? Because, you know, you did these two shows of Mike Schur's, right?
This show, and then
Good Place, right?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a deep connection between those two shows. I think there's everything that Mike Schur does. Mike Schur, the showrunner. There's a connection between those two. They're really smart shows that grapple in a sitcom form a bunch of really kind of ambitious, I don't know if they're exactly ideas, although I think The Good Place has actually some ambitious ideas in it, but also ambitious themes about goodness and virtue and other things. And yet they also are really, really funny. And they have this huge place in the culture. What's it like to work with, I mean, on both those shows, this one and that one, working with someone who's, I don't know, kind of like a certified genius in that way? There's just a vision in the middle of that. And it's part of why I think these are the things you're known for, right?
Yeah.
I mean, particularly Parks and Rec.
Yeah. I mean, Mike is obviously a hyper intelligent, deeply funny person. And I think that with Parks, he was pushing something really good into the world. We went there feeling like we had world-class jokes, like not just Mike, but the whole writer's room. It was just filled with the most talented group of men and women. And we got these great jokes. It was so funny. But also we all felt really good about what we were doing. And we all felt kind of warmly about the show and about each other. And I feel like that really came across on screen. You could really feel it watching it, that these people were enjoying each other and enjoying what they were doing. And I think Good Place even pushes that even further. I think The Good Place being in the world is, because I remember it premiered soon after the first debate or one of the Trump-Clinton debates.
Right, in 16. And then went on a hiatus after he won for a little while and then came back for a few more episodes in 2017. It's very much a series of that moment, it feels like to me. And like the idea of, for people know The Good Place, there was a story about him. I've never met Mike Schur, but I've heard a million things about him. There's a story about him where he had all these David Foster Wallace quotes on his walls. Well, he worked on Parks and Rec and on The Good Place.
Oh, yeah.
And they're the same things in the center of all those things. Office, Parks and Rec, and Good Place.
Yeah.
Good Place is the most explicit one.
Yeah.
Here's a show that's about kind of what it means to be good. It's about moral philosophy on
that's
some
right.
level. And the David Foster Wallace quote that was on his wall for a lot of this says, from an interview that Foster Wallace gave, obviously, before he died. He said, look, man, we probably, most of us agree that these are dark times and stupid ones, but do we need fiction that does nothing but dramatize how dark and stupid everything is? In dark times, the definition of good art would seem to be art that locates and applies CPR to those elements of what's human and magical and that still live and glow despite the times' darkness. Really good fiction could have as dark a worldview as it wished, but it'd find a way both to depict this world and to illuminate the possibilities for being alive and human in it. That's like all of his stuff.
Yeah.
There's something about the reason why this work that you've had the privilege of being in, why those shows connected within the standard guise of a 22-minute network sitcom. The ambition of that is vaulting and almost ludicrous to try to make a show about moral philosophy and goodness and put it on network television
in
a sitcom format. But the reason why it's stuck is because people connect to that deeper stuff.
And the degree of difficulty is increased so exponentially, like you said, being stuffed into 21 and a half minutes on NBC, on a network. And I find that those shows are doing so much more good being beamed out to any household in America for free. Anyone has access to this. And just the good place, the device of being able to curse on it and just changing the curse words because of the world they're inhabiting was just a master stroke as well. But just the fact that Mike is, I hope he continues working in network TV as well, because having these things that are made for a mass audience, but not made for a mass audience, you know, they're both of those two things at the same, made for a mass audience, but not talking down to the mass audience, like putting out something that Mike feels the mass audience is ready for and more than smart enough for.
They did a little digital short about Trevor, your character, the demon in the show. They did a little digital short that's like the best of Trevor that NBC did at some point on The Good Place. These are a little obscure catchphrases rather than actual scene.
Sure.
You should smile more. You have such a pretty smile.
Red.
We're still waiting on that smile, gorgeous.
We hooked up.
No, we didn't.
Yeah, but who are they going to believe, me or a woman?
Perfect double date. Two losers, a trash bag, and a demon. Let's hit it.
Someone made a person out of wet mulch and leaves and, like, dead slugs, and that's you.
Fire in the hole. Watch your heads, ladies. The dudes tend to boomerang around the room.
Oh, man. He's gonna make a primo dump later on.
Jesus.
I mean, it's moral philosophy with fart jokes.
Oh, what a terrible person. This is genuinely fun and flattering that you guys put these clips together, but it's also, I've played a lot of like horrible people.
Yes, but
coming to realize.
The great thing about that is, like we said, it's kind of working within that format. And it must be just a lot of fun to play. That is a joyful performance. And Kristen Bell's a great friend of yours who you've been on a lot of things with over the years.
Yeah, she did Party Down as well. Yeah, she's great.
Speaking of which, it's coming back.
Yeah.
This is not a Mike Schur thing, right? The thing about Party Down is that Party Down is not about moral philosophy.
No.
Or what it means to be good. I just want, for anybody who's not a Party Down fan, doesn't know anything about Party Down, what is Party Down? Why is it coming back? It was not, again, like Step Brothers, although even on a more, like not a lot of people saw it when it was originally.
Oh, no, when it was out. You know, part of the reason I feel it's special as it is when it was out, no one knew it existed. Like, we couldn't get magazines or newspapers or whatever to even review it. Some did, but we were just begging for attention just so people could find out about it. I think the series finale got astronomically, what ended up being the series finale, got really low numbers. But that's part of what made it special, because no one was watching. We were just doing it for ourselves. and for each other and just having the best time. And we thought what we were doing was really cool, but figured no one would ever see it. So we're just going to do it for fun. And then people discovered it after it was canceled.
It truly is a cult classic. That is, this is like actually the definition of a cult classic, right? Also, a really quite, a filthy show. It's a show about a catering company.
Yes, a catering company. And so each episode is a different event being catered by this catering company. And the catering company is made up of showbiz sort of fallouts, like an ex-actor, someone trying to be a writer. It's Jane Lynch, Martin Starr, Megan Mullally, Lizzie Kaplan, Ken Marino, Ryan Hansen. Hope I'm not forgetting anyone. It's an incredible cast. It's just all like heavyweights.
Originally on 2010?
2009. We started shooting in 2008.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So we were talking about a decade has passed.
Yeah.
And like there was demand to bring it back.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome.
People are really thrilled. And every time someone asks me about Party Down, I'm like, so you've seen it? Like, I'm still kind of amazed and thrilled. Because I think people had to really dig it up to find it. They had to discover it. So that it's sort of special to a lot of people, which is great. And so it's 12 years after we finished season two, we're coming back for season three. And we've been shooting now for 3 weeks or so.
Let's play that from Party Down, from Nick DeCinto's Orgy Night in 2010.
Hey, everything okay?
Besides the fact that we're catering an orgy, yeah, everything's just great.
I know. Alan Duck said he wanted us to work it, okay? And to call if it got good, so you can be in charge of that. Okay, if you're uncomfortable, I can have you switch with someone. Hey, Roman, switch with Casey, okay? Casey, you got prep and garbage.
Oh, garbage. Okay? Cool. Yeah. So for the crime of having standards, I get thrown on garbage?
Well, it's not a crime. I'm just giving you another option.
Thank you for that. That's really...
What?
Nothing. That girl has got a great ass. Hey, the two of you just go fucking tag team that ass. Do you want to tag team it together and high five each other?
Just for the record, I'm not into that. Two guys on one chick. You're a perineum away from kissing dick.
Okay.
There are many exchanges on the show related to like what the proper amount of ejaculate is.
That's another famous scene
that you're involved in. This is like a show where you're not like the asshole in the show. You're actually kind of the nicest. You're sort of the straight guy in the show.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you get to be kind of like the decent one or the semi-decent one. And you look really good in that pink bow tie.
Oh, thank you very
much. Which is kind of your, we're going to get that again on the reboot.
Yeah. Pink bow ties abound. Yeah. You know,
the show be as filthy? The show is pretty filthy in a way that I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's the same show.
It's the same show.
100%.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I remember the first day we were shooting the first episode and I was doing a scene with Lizzie Kaplan and I had never been sort of at the center of the show, kind of the straight man, like you said, around all these crazy characters. So it was an adjustment to do that rather than leaning into something. And usually I was in just a scene or two and things. So I had to really kind of really lean in and try and stuff as much performance into a scene as possible. You know, what you learn to do that over the years to try and sort of make some sort of impression. But I remember Fred Savage, who was directing, just telling me like, you can just chill out and you're the guy that we're going to like experience all these crazy people through. So just lean back and listen to Lizzie and enjoy yourself and share yourself with the camera. And it was maybe the most valuable advice I've ever gotten.
You having fun making it?
Yeah, it's so fun.
How many episodes are going to be?
We're just doing six.
Six. And they'll be on the air when?
That's a good question.
This year?
I don't know. Stars is figuring it out.
We're waiting. Yeah, Last questions. I wore my RM t-shirt today.
That's so great.
You're a podcast host.
Yeah.
And the podcast was originally a YouTube podcast.
Yeah.
Then it became an REM podcast.
REM.
And now it's a Talking Heads podcast.
Then it was Talking Heads. That was a while back, too. We haven't done another one in a while.
But it's years, right? This is like back, like this has gone on over years.
Yeah,
like
I think we started the U2 one in 2014 or something like that.
These are bands I love.
Yeah.
You and I we're the same person on this stuff.
Yeah.
Like they're all like, I mean, hard on your sleeve bands, not Talking Heads.
That's right.
I mean, but U2 and REM are both hard on your sleeve bands. I was, playing the other day. We're in the car driving back from Washington, and I was playing the song Strange Currencies from Monster from this tour, which is like one of the most plaintive, down on your knees love songs ever.
That's right. On an album that's the opposite.
That's the opposite.
Yeah.
Deep underneath all of the Adam Scott, he's the serious dramatic actor, Big Little Lies and Severance and all that. And also the kind of comic asshole.
Uh-huh.
And also the comic straight man.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath all of that, there's like this beating heart of like some profoundly romantic dude.
Yeah.
Is that what that is?
And I think I get a lot of that from the, you know, I think REM was perfect in that period of time when we were teenagers, because it was like, you know, this incredibly popular band with sensitive males. Like the Smiths wasn't totally up my alley because maybe it was leaning in too much to the vulnerability and the plaintiveness. But REM was just right in the middle. And for whatever reason, it just struck a chord with me. And they were just, they still are my favorite.
More than U2?
Yes.
More than U2?
I think so, yeah. Wow. Yeah, for me, yes. And that's why we did the podcast. We followed, because I didn't want to do that.
But you love U2.
I do. Absolutely. And you do.
I love them both. If somebody asked me to choose between them, it'd be very
popular. So you wouldn't be able to choose?
Very hard. Very hard to choose.
Okay. What's your favorite REM record?
Well, I'll tell you, the record that changed my life was Murmur.
Yeah.
It changed my life because I don't think that was like a music from Mars.
Okay.
It's like you first heard Radio for Europe and you're like, what the fuck is this? I've never heard anybody make music like this before. It's totally strange.
That's right.
I think that Automatic for the People is the best record.
Yeah.
Like, it's the best record.
Abbey Road.
And it's what Snipe, it's what the band thinks that too.
Yeah.
That Night Swimming, Man on the Moon, those songs are, you know.
I think once they disbanded, they admitted that Automatic was, you know what? Yes. Accelerate is also one of my favorites.
I know you like some of the late ones that people don't like.
You don't like those?
No, I think they're fine. No, I like them. Yeah. I like them. I've heard you publicly advocate for albums that others don't advocate for.
But Accelerate is good. Kind of their big comeback, and I think it's incredible song. And Collapse Into Now.
Too. And how excited were you to have you had Bono and the band on the YouTube podcast? How excited was that?
It was incredible. We had all four of them on.
You had all four. But your REM podcast, you only got Mike Mills? Did you not get the
band? No, we got Mike Mills. Then we had Mike Mills and Michael Stipe.
Yeah.
And then we got Peter Buck too. We had a live show of the podcast and had an REM cover band from, I think, Connecticut come out to play and surprised them in the middle of a song that they were playing. We had Peter Buck come out and join them on stage. And keeping Peter Buck secret from this REM cover band required like secret service level secrecy, and it was unbelievable. And halfway through it, we're just pulling our hair out trying to orchestrate this whole thing. And we're like, wait, why are we going to all this trouble to surprise five dudes in a cover band we've never even met before? But it was totally worth it, because the look on their faces when their hero walked out and plugged in and started playing Pretty Persuasion or whatever it was.
Favorite YouTube album?
Probably either Joshua Tree, Octoon Baby, or How to Dismantle Atomic Bomb. Okay. What about you?
I think Octoon Baby is the best of those records. I think Joshua Tree's meant everything to everybody.
Yeah.
And I think that All That You Can't Leave Behind for the moment that it happened was a record that
even Side 2?
Side 1's better than Side 2. It's true. But, you know, that post 9/11 moment.
It was incredible.
That tour.
Talk about something that was conceived before something that
had a different thing. When that album came out, I thought it was great. I loved the record. But after 9/11 happened here, I was at that Madison Square Garden show, the first show they played in Madison Square Garden when they first did that. We were just talking about it because of the Super Bowl the other day, and people were rating halftime performances, and people talk about that 2002.
Because it was January 2002.
Well, the show here was in October. Wow. They were the first big concert to play in a big room, and people were afraid to be at Madison Square Garden, and yet everybody came, and that was the night they first unfurled the names of the dead, and all of the first responders and firemen rushed the stage, and it was like in a spontaneous thing where there were like 500 weeping firemen on stage with the band when they first rolled the thing out, and that was the thing that they built on to ultimately became the Super Bowl performance. So that was
that's special.
Well, it was also that, you know, that became, to your point about the point we were making before about how the context changes and then the art changes.
Yeah, inside and the context. Walk On obviously was written before 9/11, but it fit perfectly, as was City of Ruins, the Springsteen song, written before 9/11.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And it's unbelievable.
You're great to stop by.
Thank you for having me. We've been trying to do this forever.
It's been nuts. I'm glad we're able to do it in person.
Huge fan of yours.
I'm off the charts. I literally could do like a 4-hour interview with you, but you'd be like falling asleep with your head on the desk. But it was great to have you here.
Thank you.
You got to catch a plane. Congratulations on Severance. It's awesome.
Thank you.
Hell and High Water is a podcast from The Recount. Thanks again to Adam Scott for being with us. If you like this episode, please subscribe to Hell and High Water and share us and rate us and review us on whatever app you happen to use to bask in the splendor of the podcast universe. I am your host and the executive editor of The Recount, John Heilman. Grace Weinstein is a co-creator of Hell and High Water. Pierre Benamé and David Wilson engineered the podcast. Justin Chermel handles the research. Margot Gray is our assistant producer. Stephanie Stender is our post producer. And the one and only Marshall Eisen is our executive producer.